Today on Against the Grain, conservative think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and the Cato Institute have had enormous success in shaping political ideas and policy over the last 40 years. But historian Jason Stahl argues that some of their greatest achievements have been in remaking the terrain on which historically liberal think tanks have operated. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Right-wing think tanks have played a key role in remaking American society into a world where the unfettered free market rules and fortune shines almost exclusively on the wealthy. Research and public relations institutions made up of conservative intellectuals, organizations like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute, have achieved this by waging a campaign of ideas. Yet, as historian Jason Stahl asserts, these ideas have been distinguished not by the merits of their arguments, but by the power of their marketing. Nonetheless, he argues that one of the right's biggest victories has been in reshaping liberalism. In Right Moves, the conservative think tank in American political culture since 1945, which is published by the University of North Carolina Press, he has written the first in-depth history of right-wing think tanks. Stahl teaches at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. Jason, can you describe the world that conservative think tanks came out of in the mid-20th century? How did conservatives see their plight at that time?
We're thinking about the period here, I would say, from World War II, like within the war, until the late 1960s. They definitely saw themselves as profoundly marginalized figures. And I think so much of what they tried to do in that roughly three-decade or 25-year period was to think about, okay, how do we move out of that marginalized space, particularly because most of think tanks, most of the right-wing and think tanks that existed during that period would operate out of more what we would conceive of kind of elite environs, whether it was think tanks, whether it was a publication like National Review. And they worked and tried to figure out new ways within those spaces to then move from the margins to the mainstream, particularly which my book in this era is focused on, the realm of political economy. So how do we think about, they feel marginalized from a liberal sort of Keynesian orientation within public policy making circles within most economics departments at the time, et cetera, et cetera. And so what they're trying to do in this time is figure out, can we make a renewed case for sort of what we would conceive of as laissez-faire old libertarian economic frameworks? And is that possible? And if so, how? And so were they going to try, something entirely different than getting these sort of older economic frameworks back into play? Or were they going to try to be a part of the mainstream conversation at the time? And if so, how was that going to happen? So it was a lot of, I think it based a lot of kind of questioning of, what do they do about this perceived and very real, I think, in many ways, marginalization?
What was the source of the funding of conservative think tanks in that period where they saw themselves in the wilderness in the mid-century? Who, by and large, were their backers?
Big business. And this was part of the problem. I think that, this is the way everybody would have conceived as them being funded, themselves, to the extent that other people paid attention to them, more liberal actors, they would say the same things. It was big business. It was corporations. It was, these entities. Almost solely, I feel very comfortable saying there was no, you go from the late 40s, you look at a place like the American Enterprise Institute, which before that was American Enterprise Association. It was seen from the late 1940s through the early 1960s as a business association funded by business entities for business interests. And that was a big part of the problem then, is then within the sort of public policy discourse of the time, they would have been seen then as a fundamentally, you know, biased institutions toward corporate and big business interests. Coming out of the Depression, this was still viewed with enormous skepticism, and was, you know, part and parcel of their marginalization. So then a lot of what they had to do, the people who sort of controlled these institutions, let's think through new ways of dealing with that problem, which was related, obviously, to the first problem of marginalization that I just talked about.
Well, tell us more about the American Enterprise Institute, its emergence, its ideology, and the sort of orientation that it took.
Yeah, so I think, you know, American Enterprise Institute, they come out of, you know, the World War II era. I mean, started a little bit before that, but in terms of anybody paying any sort of attention to them at all, it's not until the war, and then shortly after the war, you start to see little bubbles of conversation about them. And again, you know, they're funded by, again, business entities. The people that control them, you know, conceive of themselves as, conservative actors. But also, how do we make ourselves part of a more mainstream conversation? Can we do that, given that we are primarily funded by business interests, given that anything we say will be immediately sort of painted with that brush? And so a lot of what I talk about in the 50s, then, after they get taken over by a new guy, William Baruti, is that Baruti initially, late 50s, early 60s, thinks the best way to get involved in this, in any sort of national debate, is to, really kind of situate yourself almost as a referee of sorts. There was a sense, okay, we can speak for a conservative viewpoint or a business viewpoint, but we also have to present this as a debate. We're part of, here's a policy. So they would put out all these policy primers, and they would say, here's this issue being debated in Congress, and here's what liberal congressmen are saying, and we want to make sure the conservative viewpoint gets out there. So we'll sort of put out a seemingly, you know, nonpartisan sort of primer. Here's the conservative position. Here's the liberal position, et cetera. And that was the first way they tried to sort of be important, I guess, in many ways. And, a lot of congressmen, and primarily men at the time, would have paid attention to them in this way. They would have looked at these primers as a way just to maybe understand issues. They often got blurbs from conservative and liberal congressmen. And so they achieved some kind of relevance in that way, but it definitely wasn't aggressively forwarding what we would see as a conservative policy position. And that didn't change really then until the late 60s. And at that point, they and others heading into the early 70s had a reorientation to seeing themselves as institutions which will forward more aggressively, stridently conservative positions.
And what led to that shift? Was it something that was going on within the larger orientation of right-wing politics in the late 60s, obviously era of Nixon, that led to a more aggressive approach?
Yeah, that's part of it. So I think that Nixon was very often looked at skeptically by the conservative right, I think there was a sort of becoming emboldened by, here's a Republican who's been elected. But also this sort of, I think people in the moment, if we're thinking about from 1967 through 1973, right, it's this real period of transition and flux and people having a wider sense that things are breaking down, right? So we're thinking about the way policy has been debated is now viewed with skepticism when you have domestic and international crises going on that seemingly could be very, I think, easily in a lot of ways painted as kind of coming out of a liberal post-war orientation. And the right was then really able to capitalize on that and say, it's not just the policies that are at fault, but it's the way in which policies have been debated that are at fault. And policies were debated without a full understanding of a conservative position in a particular policy debate. And so what you got is a bunch of liberal policies that then didn't work. And so what conservatives really were successful in doing, and this is the mid part of my book that I talk about, is reframing the policy debate from the way all policies are debated, from what historians and I talk about as a more kind of liberal technocratic orientation, to a marketplace of ideas, where conservatives then were saying, no, we need to view policy debates through the market lens. And a market is failing if it does not take into account the various viewpoints. And here, it wouldn't have been, we need to take into account 10 different viewpoints. It's we need to take into account painted a conservative viewpoint and a liberal viewpoint. And so then within that, they could have said, now we are the perfect institutions to offer the conservative viewpoint. We know, they would say, we know who offers a liberal viewpoint. It's the media, it's academia, and liberal legislators. And so now we, those of us in conservative think tanks, are coming in with a stridently conservative position to balance that marketplace of ideas.
Historian Jason Stahl is my guest. He's the author of Right Moves, the conservative think tank in American political culture since 1945. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So it sounds like, in essence, that the conservative think tanks really got traction, or that there was a real shift in their fortunes because, in part anyway, of a crisis in liberalism, culminating the economic crisis of the 1970s, which put into question whether the Keynesian model was working. How important were economic policies and ideas around economics in the challenge that the right-wing think tanks posed, and of course the politicians who would be connected to them?
I mean, I definitely, situate them as being extremely important. I think from through the 1970s, obviously, into the Reagan administration and the 1980s, I think they were these sort of fundamental sort of binding policies for the right that then also could be sort of situated in a wider media public policy environment as being seen as these sort of conservative answers to the liberal economic problems of the late 60s and early 70s. And so, there's a few examples here. In the 70s chapter, I focus a lot on deregulation. I think the idea of a sort of out of control regulatory framework is one of the, significant economic ideas, deregulation that sort of emerges out of these spaces, these think tanks that I talk about. And, enormous pull and sway, not only in, making policy, but also sway over both parties, Democratic and Republican. And then switching into the 1980s, a big part of my chapter on the Reagan administration focuses on the development of supply side economics as a framework to sort of counter what's perceived, obviously, as demand-side economics or a Keynesian framework. So it's a very kind of easy way to sort of think about a counterposition to key central tenets of post-war liberalism, mid-century liberalism, you could even say, right? Regulatory framework, progressive taxation. And so here you have then two key counter ideas that conservatives can very easily institute in the 70s and 80s, easily sort of sell in a wider marketplace and with public policymakers. Deregulation in the 70s and then obviously continuing into the 80s, and then supply side economics being developed as an idea in the 1970s and then implemented in the 1980s. These are just, I focus so heavily on them because I think they are such strong evidence of what I'm trying to say in those mid chapters in terms of thinking about this reorientation of how we think about policy debate. Those two ideas are just really, really key.
And supply-side economics, the idea that deregulation and cutting taxes on the wealthy will lead to greater investment and growth that will then benefit everyone.
Exactly also, right. And I mean, I would just add very quickly, when you're thinking about the emergence of that framework in the 70s, I would take it even a step further, because that's what conservative think tanks did. They said it isn't just it would spur investment and what it was a very striking, incorrect, bold claim that decreased taxation on the wealthy, lowering top marginal rates will actually increase revenues from taxation to the federal government. This is sort of a mind-boggling claim that is not true, but they had an enormous success in selling. So it was selling these sort of top marginal tax cuts in an actually progressive way. I mean, I think that's what sort of liberals and leftists need to sort of wrap our heads around, is that it wasn't sold as like, oh, we're going to give the wealthy more. It was sold as we can cut taxes on the wealthy and we won't have to cut the welfare state, or we won't have to, because we're going to get all this increased revenue from sort of increased investment or job creation or something, right? So it's a much even bolder claim, I think, than what you just said.
Sure. And then supply-side economics, you argue, is in many ways emblematic of the kinds of ideas that conservative think tanks put forward, in that the empirical basis of the argument was really, really shaky. And yet, yep, of course, these are ideas that have incredible staying power from the 1970s to now. So talk about that dimension of all of this, that when you were talking about the shift of policy making and policy thinking from a technocratic approach to the open marketplace of ideas, some of it is about actually, you know, marketing and selling things without
necessarily
substance.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that conservatives very quickly realized then that very often what would be needed when we're in this new realm of the marketplace of ideas and sort of, sell, as you correctly say, selling policy within a marketplace, that empirical claims are just simply less important, because what's important to get your voice heard is to situate it as the conservative position that will balance out the liberal position that we already know. And so, you know, I think conservatives were very, you know, quick to realize in spaces like think tanks that you didn't have to, it did a great disservice to sort of influence policy to, let's say, have researchers working on a, you know, sound policy for years and sending it out for peer review and whatever. I mean, this is the exact opposite of what places like AEI and places like Heritage did. They very quickly realized in the 70s, and then Heritage really taking it to the next level in the 80s and 90s, realizing that, no, speed is what's important, right? If you want to be involved in the debate, if you want to get your position heard, getting it out there quickly, in a very short, abbreviated way, so that people are talking about it, that's the most important thing, and situating it as the conservative identified policy.
Well, you talk about another stage in the history of right-wing think tanks, which is that in the 1980s, when obviously the dreams of these people in the wilderness were then realized under Ronald Reagan. And I wonder if you could tell us about how they shaped the ideas of that period. And then I'm going to ask you later in the program about social movements as they relate to the Democratic Party. But what was the relationship in that era, in the Reagan period, between think tanks on the right and social movements on the right?
So I think that the key think tank to talk about here in the 80s, if we're thinking about that sort of the connection between seemingly more elite environs and like places like think tanks or the National Review and the grassroots, sort of grassroots conservative actors, activists, right? You really want to talk about the Heritage Foundation. You want to think about the way in which Heritage is a think tank, started in the early 70s, but still kind of trying to gain their footing, really, through much of the 1970s. I mean, I think that, you know, this is, people have sort of assumed, well, Heritage has started in 1973, and then they're off and running. That's really not it. In the, throughout the 1970s, they were really trying to figure out how to be relevant. AEI was definitely the dominant conservative think tank in the 1970s. Heritage was trying to gain its footing, trying to figure out where they belonged. And where they finally figured it out is they had the fullest grasp by, I'd say, 1980 of this whole marketplace of ideas model and how to win public policy debates within that way of debating policy. That's number one. But then number two, connecting back to your question, they realized that they had to draw off the energies of an emerging grassroots right. And the way they did that is they had a financial trouble in the late 1970s. I have to go back and look at the book, 77, 78, around there. They were getting too much of their funding from conservative millionaires, essentially, Joseph Kors, others, that they were running into tax trouble in terms of situating themselves as a sort of getting tax-exempt status. They were getting these massive checks from conservative millionaires. They were able then to tap into this emerging direct mail conservative financing effort that really drew out this emerging grassroots strength that was bubbling up in the 1970s, and they tapped into it. So in late 70s, early 80s, all of a sudden they have this direct mailing list of 120,000 people by 1981, where a lot of people donate these small dollar amounts. Yeah, we tend to think of Heritage, I think correctly in a lot of ways, as being, you know, funded by millionaires and so forth, billionaires, whatever. But, you know, during that period, they really established a kind of grassroots way of thinking about themselves. And then even their publications then able to speak to multiple audiences. They said, you know, they always made fun of AEI at Fulner, who ran the Heritage during this period in the late 70s and 80s, and then, you know, for the next 30 years after that. He often, you know, sort of positioned himself, he made fun of AEI for producing book-length studies and not understanding that, you know, you got to produce policy primers quickly. You have to speak to multiple audiences. You have to make the most of media appearances. And so in terms of connecting with that grassroots right, it was done in those two ways, funding, number one, and number two, through making sure that the policy conversations they were creating were able to all not just connect with policymakers and others, but connect with that grassroots, either through media appearances and or just the way they wrote their various publications. So I think they were the ones who were really able to create that kind of symbiosis between the grassroots element or how we think about grassroots right and elite right. They really kind of, you know, blurred that divide.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Right Moves, the Conservative Think Tank in American Political Culture Since 1945. That's published by the University of North Carolina Press, and its author is Jason Stahl. He teaches in the Department of Organizational Leadership, Policy, and Development at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. And I'm Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jason, we've been talking about the ways that right-wing think tanks shaped policy, particularly around economic policy. But I wanted to ask you about the role of right-wing think tanks in reshaping foreign policy from the 80s up until the present, in effect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think my book in terms of a balance of the book, is definitely more oriented to domestic policy. But the one place where that's not true is thinking about what we would, you know, articulate as a neoconservative position now. Thinking about, and, you know, the way we think about the position now is very much in the realm of foreign policy. But that position of neoconservative in the 1970s emerged more oriented around domestic policy. And so, you know, I talk a lot about that then in the chapter that most directly focuses on the 70s. But then, as you know, we move through time and 80s, 90s, and obviously into the 2000s, you have that position, that identity of neoconservative, which I really argue one of the power bases that emerges out of in terms of thinking through what is this thing, the neoconservative. I mean, it has to be explained to people. That identity has to be articulated to people so they can sort of occupy it, right, in their sort of own political selves. So that's a lot of what I talk about in the chapter on the 70s, because this really emerges out of the American Enterprise Institute. It's one of the main power bases you see people articulating that, Irving Kristol and others articulate what is a neoconservative. Well, then by the 90s and 2000s, particularly with the end of the Cold War, you have this reorientation of the neoconservative policy, neoconservative position away from, not entirely, but very much more oriented to the foreign policy side of things. And so what I talk about in the chapter that focus primarily on the 90s is the way that they were trying to figure out, these people who identified themselves as neoconservatives, really, would they be more oriented to the Republican or Democratic Party? It wasn't clear at the time. People tend to forget this around the time Bill Clinton's running for president in 1992, and there's a sense, well, are neoconservatives in many cases rally behind Bill Clinton because he's seen as maybe more of a sort of internationalist thinker, and I don't know. So as you move through the 90s, so those people then move much more firmly into the into the Republican Party and sort of sell Republican policymakers on this idea of the neoconservative. Irving Kristol's son, Bill Kristol, obviously being kind of at the head of this, but AEI really kind of reviving itself. AEI had seen some bad times through the 80s and 90s, and by the late 90s and then into the 2000s, particularly after September 11th, really reviving their political fortunes around this identity of neoconservative and selling a sort of aggressive military militaristic foreign policy, particularly after 9/11, in terms of the response of the United States to that. And so they're instrumental, I would argue, in sort of reviving that, or really sort of selling, as we to use this somewhat awful word again, but really selling that kind of foreign policy framework.
Let's turn to the Democratic Party. You argue that conservative think tanks not only influenced politicians on the right, but they also influenced politicians who were on the center left and institutions that historically had been liberal. Tell us about the influence of conservative think tanks on the orientation of the Brookings Institute and the Democratic Leadership Council's think tank, the Progressive Policy Institute.
Okay, so two big, you know, interrelated questions, but I will kind of take them separately here to sort of think about two different things that happen. So on the one hand, the response of liberal institutions in the 1970s, and I would say, you know, through the 1980s, to this emergence of conservative think tanks, to the emergence of their particular way of debating policy, the marketplace of ideas. The way liberal institutions respond to this, here we're talking about the Brookings Institution, which would have been thought of as a liberal think tank through most of the sort of post-war period, and academia as well, and the media as well, all of these institutions that would have been thought primarily as sort of liberally oriented. Their response to conservative think tanks forwarding this new way of debating policy, the marketplace of ideas, their response to that is to accommodate it. That's what I argue in my book, that they then don't say, okay, yes, we are the liberal institutions and we will forward the liberal position and let you conservative think tanks forward the conservative position. What I argue is that instead they adopt this rhetorical framework of the marketplace of ideas, and they say, yes, we need to have a balanced policy debate. And what this leads them to do then is not to say they're going to be the liberally oriented institutions, but to say we're going to alter our own institutions. We're going to make sure we're going to aggressively police our institutions for two overt signs of liberalism. And so what they do, you know, Brookings ends up hiring a Republican to sort of head up their institution in 1978, I believe, and to say, no, we're not liberally biased. We are willing to sort of accommodate conservative viewpoints, corporate viewpoints, et cetera. The media, as I think we all have come to understand, I really argue that conservative think tanks are instrumental in getting the media to sort of police themselves for overt signs of liberalism. So what you had then was this strange kind of occurrence of these institutions then not fully occupying this liberal space, but saying, yes, we'll police ourselves. And what this left then was institutions which maybe at one point would have had a more strident liberalism definitely moving more towards the center, while at the same time you have the emergence of much more aggressive conservative think tanks on the other side. So to the second part of the question then, this also happens within the Democratic Party. So the Democratic Party obviously positioned as a liberal party, yes. But once this discourse gets going about the marketplace of ideas and liberal bias and so forth, that conservative think tanks are really instrumental in forwarding, you have the Democratic Party at the behest of the Democratic Leadership Council and its more direct kind of policy arm, the Progressive Policy Institute, then effectively policing the Democratic Party and suggesting then that the Democratic Party needs to move away from this kind of strident liberalism to win elections, to create policy which is better, which we would sort of think about in this kind of more neoliberal framework. I mean, this sort of, you know, discourse of neoliberalism, I think, is becoming much more kind of publicly, there's much more of a public awareness of it now, and how much of that policy planning and neoliberal discourse comes out of the Democratic Party, really at the pushing of the Democratic Leadership Council and the Progressive Policy Institute in the 1980s and 90s.
So it sounds like for the Democratic Leadership Council and their think tank, the Progressive Policy Institute, it wasn't just simply that they felt some pressure to be more balanced, so to speak, in their orientation, but it really seemed like what you're saying and what you've written, that they actually, in a very visceral way, embraced a lot of the ideas of the right and were very directly pushing them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and pushing Democrats to embrace them. Yeah, it certainly wasn't just rhetorical or, oh, we have to do this to win elections. It was the acceptance of a certain correctness of those different policies. And so when I talk about the Clinton administration, I focus on welfare reform. And, you know, welfare reform is, as we sort of think about that idea in a modern context, this emerged fully out of conservative think tanks in the 1970s. And this is, of course, signed into law by a Democratic president. And so what I talk about is, the way in which the DLC and the Progressive Policy Institute were instrumental in sort of getting Democrats to accept that particular policy and others.
Right. I mean, the Affordable Care Act also did not come out of a right-wing think tank and then was embraced by the Democratic Party.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, I think that this shows exactly, and I end the book in an epilogue. I talk briefly about the Affordable Care Act and its emergence or different parts of that of what we now see, know as the Affordable Care Act, emerging out of the Heritage Foundation in the 1990s as a response to Bill Clinton's attempt at healthcare reform, and pieces of it even earlier than that. This is seen as the conservative policy response, more market-oriented response to a more statist policy of the Democratic Party. And you can see that enormous shift to the entire political spectrum right there with that policy, where then by the time Obama is elected under, you know, and again, it's not to say that everything about the Affordable Care Act emerged out of the Heritage Foundation. Heritage would have certainly been against the expansion of Medicaid, for instance. But in terms of the exchanges, in terms of a mandate forcing people to buy insurance, et cetera, these things are, you know, this was seen as the market-oriented solution, a conservative market-oriented solution to a more kind of welfare statist policy of the Democratic Party. But then Obama takes up as the, the standard bearer for the Democratic Party, and then the conservative position moves fully against it, right? It doesn't need to be repeated for everyone. I mean, we recognize the way in which the Republican Party has been steadfast against, from the beginning, the Affordable Care Act, and continues to be to this day. So you can see right there just exactly the kind of shift we're talking about.
Indeed. I'm speaking with historian Jason Stahl. He's the author of Right Moves, the conservative think tank in American political culture since 1945. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. And I'm Sasha Lilly. In the 1990s, the Democratic Leadership Council shifted the Democratic Party away from its traditional base, including in the labor unions and social movements, to a new basis focusing on upper middle class professionals in the suburbs, an ideology that was much more overtly pro-business. What happened there? You write a lot about Jesse Jackson, the politics of race in the Democratic Party, and how he was seen as the epitome of the kind of politics that needed to be left behind for this new makeover of the Democratic Party, leaving behind it the hoary old liberal past.
Yeah, and I mean, race, definitely a huge part of that. In the figure of Jesse Jackson, it's not just Jesse Jackson, a black man representing the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, the face of the Democratic Party through much of the liberal end of the Democratic Party through the 1980s. Places like the Democratic Leadership Council move that critique in a much broader way, or they position the critique of Jackson in a much broader, much more pernicious way. And so what I argue in the book is it's much more about the orientation against his particular way of thinking about politics. So the DLC positions itself and its new identity, the new Democrat, the mainstream Democrat. This is the kind of product they're selling. They position that against Jackson's overall type of politics. That is the Rainbow Coalition, bringing together a united sort of front of social movements to take power, to embolden ordinary Americans and people to take power, right? It's this grassroots orientation of politics. This is Jackson the organizer, right? This is the political framework he comes out of. The DLC positions themselves in this identity that they're selling, the mainstream Democrat, the new Democrat, as being against that type of politics. So it's being suspicious of grassroots political action generally. So it's not just about policy, or it's not just about race. It's even bigger than that. It's the way in which race and policy and how we think about what the political is used by the DLC under this very much broader framework of being against the overall way of practicing politics that is Jesse Jackson, someone who emerges out of the civil rights movement and so forth. And so I think that it's much more hurtful to the Democratic Party because of that, because that's a much harder thing to then overcome. That's a much harder thing to push back against when then Bill Clinton wins. Bill Clinton wins re-election, seemingly have this kind of vindication of looking at politics in a kind of professional way. People, you know, turn out to vote, sure, but that's it. And I think that this is, and that's a, you know, that sort of speaking out against social movements or social movement politics. I mean, this has been a right-wing framework for decades. It's part of what sustains, different conservative discourses. And for then the DLC to adopt that as Democrats against the base of the Democratic Party is just profoundly hurtful, I think, to the Democratic Party and its political fortunes.
Right. So that hostility, in effect, to social movements within the Democratic Party is something that continues to this day, is a tension within the Democratic Party. But just focusing for a moment on the 1990s, this period when the Democratic Leadership Council was pushing a reorientation of the Democratic Party away from the Democratic Party of, say, the Great Society and that legacy, and with its basis in trade unions, to one that seemed much more focused on upper middle class professionals and people in the suburbs and so on. And in part, that was accompanied by a set of ideas that came out of the Democratic Leadership Council's think tank against what they termed, quote, liberal fundamentalism. Tell us what that very charged phrase meant and the significance of it.
It's all exactly right. I mean, I think that phrase, too, that they came to so aggressively employ by the early 1990s, is liberal fundamentalism, the idea that the fundamentalism, which again, by the time they were using it, would have been understood primarily as a sort of religious, a way of negatively, obviously, framing religiosity. And so that somehow then liberalism in its politics and policy is akin, and those at the base of the Democratic Party are akin to sort of religious zealots who will accept fervently these ideas in this particular type of politics without question, right? That then positions the DLC, positions these markers that they're trying to create, the mainstream Democrat, the new Democrat, as being sort of above it all, right? Of being the portion of the party that is for reason, that is for contemplation, that will, consider all points of view, et cetera, right? And so there's a way then which that particular rhetorical framing is really the one they focus most heavily on. And painting then Jackson, who is obviously a reverend, right? So it works well if you're thinking about this sort of religiosity of this as being the sort of head missionary of this particular way of thinking.
So how do you see that tension in the Democratic Party, which it sounds like you're saying is not the same sort of tension within on the right, where the more elite think tank and policy-oriented part of the right does not see itself as casting out the social movement part of the right, but within the Democratic Party, especially with its orientation in the 1990s, followed through with Clinton, et cetera, that there exists a kind of deep tension within the Democratic Party between those in the positions of policy making and thinking and those social movements that might be connected to the Democratic Party and trade unions and so on.
There you go. That's exactly right. I think that that's what we see. That's what's most striking to me as a historian looking at the 80s and 90s historically, is the utter embrace of right-wing elite actors of their base, of the grassroots. And on the flip side of things, the Democratic Party, the power centers of the will become the power centers of the Democratic Party during that same period, operating in the exact opposite way, right? Using these same types of elite spaces to not just ignore their base, but absolutely work rhetorically and in practice against their base. That's the huge difference that I really try to clarify in the in the 80s and 90s, for sure.
So then taking things up to the present, to the Trump era, how do you understand all of the forces that you've described about the ascendancy of the right, the role of right-wing think tanks, the way those think tanks have influenced the way that ideas are promulgated using this marketplace model, as you put it? How do you understand then the moment that we're in with the Trump administration, which often gets cast as being as exceptional? Do you think it can be understood, looking at the history of the right that you've been tracing?
Yes. I mean, I think that this is too often the problem, is that we have this kind of separation of Trump from what has come before it. And or that somehow he's this aberration. He's not. So I'd focus on two different things in terms of relating to the dynamics that we just talked about, and I talk about in my book. Number one, what is not the if Donald Trump is not the natural endpoint of policy and policy debates, untethered from empiricism, untethered from all claims to truth, even, or I mean, it's so, you know. If he is not the personification of what is the disastrous endpoint of this way of thinking about policy and policy debates, I don't know what is. I mean, I think he is just the logical endpoint of what I'm talking about in my book, which is a politician who absolutely has zero, you know, fixation on whether the words coming out of his mouth are truth. And the Republican Party within, you know, in terms of thinking about policy, we've had one actual attempted policy initiative at this point, and it's been the so-called repeal of Obamacare, which has been anything but. I mean, it's been the production of of policy that is just, we don't even know what the goals of the policies are. I mean, they're produced overnight. It's the debate, such as it is, that's happening right now, is so untethered from any norms of truth and empiricism in policymaking. I think this is the unfortunate, disastrous endpoint of some of the dynamics I'm talking about in my book. That's number one. Number two, in terms of thinking about this current era and its relationship, whether it's an aberration, I mean, I think the other way think tank, it's not just in terms of this broader reorientation of policy debate that I talked about in my book that I think is manifest in a figure like Trump, it's that think tanks continue to have power, but in a very new and different way. And I think I'm still grappling with this myself. Because I think in some ways the think tanks of old don't know what to do right now. We're now in this fragmented media landscape and the rise of social media and what that means for the way politics and policy debates and political debates are mediated, that I think that these think tanks of old, like AEI or like even Heritage, which tries to kind of, it was trying to do a lot of new things. I think they're still struggling with what this all means for them. And so initially I was thinking, well, are we in the era of a kind of think tanks, their power or their importance diminishing? I think we are. I think we're going through right now, media landscape is so fragmented. Policymaking is such a fragmented nightmare that I don't know that think tanks can have the kind of power that they used to or situate themselves in the same way. But the one thing I think is important to focus on is this revitalization of white supremacy and explicitly white supremacist discourses that I think as a historian, I never would have said this is dead. Although in teaching my students, sometimes maybe I cross into that line of overt organizing, explicit organizing around white supremacy is over. And I've maybe said that to my students 10 years ago. And now it's clearly not, obviously, horrifically, it is clearly not. But at this, and I think that you look behind some of these figures like Richard Spencer and others who are very adept at using social media, using kind of the new way things are seemingly operating now in terms of, you know, politically. These people emerged first out of think tanks. Richard Spencer, his first power base was a place called the National Policy Institute. It was a think tank. It was set up in 2011, I believe, and where this was, you know, designed and kind of operated the way a lot of older think tanks operated, which was, we have a new idea. That new idea is white supremacy. It's old, but it's new in the sense a lot of people wouldn't have heard it in an explicit way, and we're going to try to get it back into the discourse. But they were recognized that the media was beginning to operate in a fundamentally different way, and that to then reinsert those political discourses and identities into a national debate, you have to do it in a new way. And it's still, we're in the moment. And so what is going to happen with all this? We just don't know. But at the very least, they have been successful in using white supremacy, explicit white supremacy, as an organizing political force, in a way that I just am still flabbergasted that it's happening. But I think that at least partly this particular think tank has, and this figure and the figures around it, and recognizing the way the media works, have been profoundly, horrifically influential.
And it also seems to speak to the far right, the white supremacist right, which one can think of as these frightening mob scenes and in visceral terms, but it seems like the Richard Spencers of the world are taking ideas, absolutely repugnant ideas, very seriously. I mean, I don't know if he finished his PhD, but he was doing a PhD at Duke.
Yeah.
You know, that in some ways, these people do see themselves as intellectuals,
yep,
of really frightening social movements.
That's exactly right. And that in some ways is the most horrifying thing about it, because it's the appeal of this very sort of slick looking guy who is speaking to, in many cases, a younger white male population that does want to see themselves as intellectuals, right? Wants to see themselves as not just white supremacists, or not like some sort of rabid yahoos running around with, you know, Klan hoods on or something, but as thinkers, right? As deep thinkers. And so, you know, being around young white men, it's, you know, teaching young white men a lot, and sometimes seeing the way they don't want to intellectually engage, or it's hard, they in many ways are the hardest students to reach. And I think what worries me the most is that figures like Spencer have figured out a way to reach them at an intellectual level, to see themselves as sort of like deeper, profound thinkers, right? And that's horrifying.
Jason Stahl has been my guest. He's the author of Right Moves, the Conservative Think Tank in American Political Culture since 1945. That's published by the University of North Carolina Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Jason, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. This has been great.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.